The CBS News Weekend Roundup after this short break.
Ransomware is software that can infiltrate your business through email, enabling cyber criminals to hijack sensitive information as ransom for your own data's release. Leveraging Barracuda email security with advanced threat detection can stop a ransomware attack in its tracks. As an added measure, Barracuda Backup allows you to recover your data without having to surrender to extortion. Crime doesn't pay when you protect your business data with Barracuda. Go to Barracuda.com/ransomware to learn more.
This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup, Europe on Alert.
Those injured and dying were left bloodied and scattered along the street.
Plus, one of the president's top advisors is out.
Later, the philosophy of surfs up.
Surfers really have a sense that they're sort of blessed in their existence in a certain way.
I'm Steve Dorsey at the CBS News Washington Bureau. The State Department says one American was killed in the terror attacks in Spain, first in Barcelona, then at nearby seaside resort Cambrils. More than a dozen have died, many more injured in those attacks. More from correspondent Seth Doan in Cambrils.
Gunfire was heard from inside a Cambrils bar. Outside, police had shot dead five attackers after they drove a car into pedestrians in this coastal resort community. Six civilians and a police officer were wounded. Fitzroy Davies witnessed the police operation.
And they were shouting at the guy, and then shots were fired. He then fell down, and then within 2 seconds, he stood back up. He then stepped over the fence, charged the police again, and the police then Dunne gave some more shots, and then he fell down again.
This eyewitness said he saw suspects wearing suicide vests. We were worried, so we hid, he said. Those vests were detonated by a bomb squad and determined to be fake. Authorities say the attack here in Cambrils was linked to the one in Barcelona, which unfolded just 8 hours earlier. The attackers in that truck jumped the curb at the busy Las Ramblas in the heart of Barcelona, plowing into pedestrians. Those injured and dying were left bloodied and scattered along the street, popular with tourists. It had zigzagged for 7 blocks, apparently trying to hit as many people as possible. The driver of the van was seen escaping on foot. Authorities are saying there may have been a terrorist cell of at least 8 people who'd originally been planning an attack using gas canisters. And now police are theorizing that an explosion Wednesday, which leveled a house and was originally reported simply as a gas explosion, may be linked to these other attacks.
We're also learning about a stabbing attack in the Finnish city of Turku. At least 2 people have died. Back home now, it was a chaotic week for those covering President Trump and his response to the violence in Charlottesville. Then on Friday, the White House confirmed Steve Bannon was fired as chief strategist. Let's talk now with CBS News White House correspondent Stephen Portnoy. Stephen, what happened?
Well, Steve, we learned midday Friday that Steve Bannon's days were numbered at this White House. Our colleague Major Garrett reported this earlier in the week that Bannon was on the outs. Well, by midday Friday, it was clear that the decision had been made. It was called a mutual decision, reached both by Bannon and the new chief of staff, John Kelly, coming 3 weeks after the president tapped Kelly to come into this White House and essentially clean it out.
The president, as you know, faced a free-for-all of reporter questions. I'm hesitant to call it a press conference because access was restricted in many ways. But what do we learn from that?
Well, it was the event that pretty much touched off nearly a week's worth of controversy and responses from members of Congress and from CEOs and other outside organizations. By Friday, even members of the President's Council on the Arts and Humanities quit en masse. Of course, they were all appointed by Barack Obama, but they quit in protest. But President Trump, in taking questions from reporters for about 15 minutes, made it clear that he believes that it was both sides that were to blame for the violence in Charlottesville. And many people in the country saw that as the president giving some kind of moral equivalence between members of the alt-right, white supremacist, white nationalist, KKK side, and those who were marching in opposition to those forces.
And we're also watching the president's visit Tuesday to Arizona.
Tuesday night, he holds a rally in Phoenix, and we'll be watching it closely because it'll be the first opportunity for the president to sort of bask in the glow of his base. It also happens to be the home of Joe Arpaio, the former Maricopa County Sheriff, who just last month was convicted of contempt of court by violating a federal judge's order that he stop these illegal immigrant crackdowns, for which he became famous. President Trump told a Fox News journalist that he's considering pardoning Arpaio, that Arpaio doesn't deserve the prison term. He could face up to 6 months for that contempt conviction. And President Trump just happens to be going to Maricopa County on Tuesday night.
CBS News White House correspondent Stephen Portnoy, great talking with you.
You too, Steve. Thanks.
Virginia's Governor, Democrat Terry McAuliffe, talked about Charlottesville with Charlie Rose in CBS This Morning.
Should all Confederate memorials and monuments be taken down?
I think so. They need to come down. They're divisive symbols. Several years ago, I used executive authority to take the Confederate flag off of our license plates here in Virginia. I don't have the authority to do that with monuments. Local control, local jurisdictions, as well as the General Assembly would control. It's time for us to move together after what happened in Charlottesville. But let me just say this, Charlie. It's not just about monuments. These people who came to Charlottesville, the neo-Nazis, the alt-right, they weren't here about a statue. They went to the University of Virginia on Friday night with their torches. That had nothing to do with the statue. There is hatred, there is bigotry that has been unleashed in this country. And we need to understand how it's happened, most importantly, what we can do going forward as a nation.
And does the president's response to this suggest that he's unfit to be president?
Well, I can say this. I disagree strongly with the president and his remarks that this was all about the Lee statue. As I just mentioned, it wasn't. This is hatred. We got to address it. These were not patriots. These were cowards. And I've talked to the president. Let us use this time to bring people together. We are a United States of America, and the hatred that I saw, I'm telling you, Charlie, I've never seen the language and the things were said about individuals, members of the African-American community, members with Jewish faith, members of the LGBT community. There's no place for it in Virginia. I told them to go home, but let's be honest. There's no place in America for this type of hatred. So I've established a reconciliation committee. Mm-hmm. We're moving forward. And to see those people at University of Virginia on the lawn yesterday, that is who Virginia is.
Governor, did you say that you spoke with President Trump? And what did you tell him?
Well, when I talked to him, you know, he called me right before he gave his press conference. And I said, Mr. President, and I've been seeing the video all day. It's hatred. It's bigotry. It's racism. It needs to stop in this country. And I said, let us work together for reconciliation. Let us go forward to bring our nation back together again. And, you know, he agreed with me on the phone call, but, you know, I don't understand the statements he made.
But then, Governor, after that phone call, he had that remarkable news conference. And when it was over, you issued a statement saying we need real leadership in this country. What does real leadership look like to you in this case? And do you still want him to come to Charlottesville?
That was not leadership, what I saw. And those remarks are dividing people. We cannot be dividing people.
Do you want him to come? You had asked him to come over the weekend. Do you still feel that way?
Listen, if the president wants to come to Charlottesville and address our citizens, talk about how we can heal as a nation and how we need to move forward, that is what the president of the United States should do. I do not want the president to come here to continue on with the speeches that he's given the last couple days.
Still to come, a new message to North Korea from the U.S.
We call on North Korea to choose a better path than one of provocation and threats.
That's next on the Weekend Roundup. On the CBS News Weekend Roundup, I'm Steve Dorsey. Secretary of Defense James Mattis met with Secretary of State Rex Tillerson and their counterparts from Japan at the Pentagon Thursday, and Mattis had another warning for North Korea.
We call on North Korea to choose a better path than one of provocation and threats. Such a path is not in its own best interest, nor in the best interest of any other nation.
CBS News Chief White House Correspondent Major Garrett and Political Director Steve Shigera spoke about the North Korean nuclear threat with former Defense Secretary William Cohen for the latest edition of their podcast, The Takeout.
Help our audience, if you could, Mr. Secretary, understand the linkages between China and North Korea and how central it is or is not to a peaceful resolution of this ever-escalating conflict.
There can never be a peaceful solution or resolution of the situation on the Korean Peninsula without China. China is one of the major supporters of the North Koreans. I've said on many different outlets that the North Koreans have a guns and butter policy. they've been able to develop these missiles and weapons while enjoying the butter furnished by the Russians, the Chinese, and others in the region. The only way we can ever try to bring about a successful conclusion to their expansion, North Korean's expansion of their missile and technology program, is to force them to face the economic consequences of deprivation. And that means the Chinese would have to severely cut back the business they're doing with them. I'm not sure they're prepared to do it at this moment, but I've talked to the Chinese. I have two offices over there. So I talk to them and say, look, it's in your interest to make sure that violence doesn't break out on the peninsula. It's in your interest to see, ultimately, a unified Korea, because basically South Korea is one of their major trading partners. North Korea is a burden on their economy. So if you're looking at it strategically, wouldn't it be great if you had a unified Korea in which the United States would not pose any kind of a military challenge to the Chinese, but rather had a peaceful peninsula as such that was not militarized the way it is? They could then, the Korean people could be united, they could be prosperous, they could not present a threat to anybody in the region. That would be in China's long-term interest. Right now they see the threat of the United States being on their border if there were a united Korea under the circumstances where there were a...
Separated only by the Yalu River.
Right. So there's a way to resolve this. And I think the president is correct. I give him credit when he is correct that the Chinese have more to do. They can, in fact, squeeze the North Koreans to the point where they could almost break them. They're worried about the flux of people who would scatter to the north.
Refugees.
Refugees or military, and those scattering to the south as far as the South Koreans concerned. So I've always tried to encourage, let's have a plan here. What happens if things go south? What do the Chinese do? What do we do? If we see millions of people coming over the DMZ heading to Seoul, are they refugees? Are they soldiers? Do they get shot at? Do they get welcomed? And the same thing for the Chinese. So this is potentially very volatile for both. So I think there's a deal to be made. I think the Chinese are the biggest players. I think the Russians are in this too, that we could work out these disagreements if we sat down and said, let's find a way to peacefully reunite the peninsula.
Steve Chigueras.
Can we talk a little bit about the war of words that happened over the last week between President Trump and Kim Jong-un? There was a lot of concern of what the president said, his fire and fury comments, and his continued comments afterwards, that potentially this is putting us on the brink of something. And then what wound up happening this week was what normally happens, it seems, with North Korea, which is they back off at the end of the day. I know it was a completely untraditional way of handling North Korea, but in hindsight, what is your take on how the president handled all of this?
Well, he's president. I'm not. I would not have handled it this way. I would have handled it the way Jim Mattis handled it, in saying directly to the North Koreans, if you ever consider attacking the United States, our allies, our territories, you will be met with overwhelming response. Very direct message, no fire and brimstone, that's the message. What I don't want to see is the president engage in a kind of diplomatic trash talk. My guns are bigger than your guns. My bombs are better than your bombs.
Were you worried at any point during this last week or so that North Korea was going to take this to another level? Because there were a lot of people that were very worried about Guam or the U.S. or were you one of those people?
You can't tell. That's the when you can't calculate what Kim Jong-un is going to do, then you have to be on edge.
Was it important in this context when the Chinese said through the foreign ministry that if there is any attack from the North Koreans on Guam or any U.S. territory, it's on its own? Was that important?
Very important.
Tell us why.
Because the North Koreans, North Korea doesn't exist without the Chinese. So for the Chinese to say you're on your own and then cut back the economic support they have, that pretty much would stir, in my judgment, a rebellion from within. You would have a change of regime coming from within, which is a risk that the North Koreans are running right now.
Although Kim Jong-un has backed off his threat to target Guam with a missile, the military is still taking precautions to defend the small U.S. island territory. David Van Camp visited Guam to report for Portland CBS News radio affiliate KXL's Markley and Van Camp Show. Our Stephanie Pawlowski talked with him.
Why did you decide to take the show there? Well, I think as we were watching a lot of the coverage unfold about some very serious threats that are being made, obviously, from North Korea against the United States and in particular Guam, we just saw an opportunity to actually go there and tell the story and not just, you know, report from Guam, but actually host a show from Guam, from this little island that is the focal point for this brewing international crisis that's going on right now, and just get the real story from real people who are here, how they feel about all this attention and how they feel about this this particular threat that may be imminent from North Korea or may not be.
How are people feeling?
You know, it's kind of mixed, but the overall reaction from most people I'm talking with is, yeah, we're on alert, but, you know, at the end of the day, North Korea has made threats with us before. They've done tests in our direction before. We're not as panicked as a lot of people seem to think that we are. And also, a lot of folks around here seem to feel safer just because of the military presence here, because they feel like they're going to be taken care of regardless.
The Navy is punishing nearly a dozen American service members for their role in the crash between the USS Fitzgerald and a cargo ship off the coast of Japan in June. A newly released report details the moment the destroyer collided with a Philippine container ship. That container ship punched a 17 by 13 foot hole in the Fitzgerald's hull. An area where 35 sailors were sleeping flooded in less than a minute. The seven sailors closest to the impact drowned. The captain of that ship, Commander Bryce Benson, and two top senior crew members were relieved of duty. Up next, how well equipped are hospitals for a cyber attack? On the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
The CBS News Weekend Roundup after this short break.
Upgrade your summer cookouts with Gourmet Omaha Steaks. They offer a huge menu of steaks and more. All high-quality ingredients, and every purchase is backed by Omaha Steaks' 100% unconditional guarantee. Right now, you can get this limited-time deal, an exclusive savings of 80% on a very special combo, the Summer Sensation. You get all of this. 2 5-ounce filet mignons, 2 5-ounce top sirloins, 4 4-ounce boneless pork chops, 4 3.5-ounce chicken fried steaks, a 12-ounce package of all beef meatballs, 4 4-ounce Omaha steak burgers, 4 4-ounce gourmet jumbo franks, a 16-ounce package of Omaha steakhouse fries, 4 caramel apple tartlets, an Omaha steak seasoning packet, plus 4 more Omaha steak burgers. This exclusive package is only $49.99. Go to omahasteaks.com, type FTN in the search bar, and add the Summer Sensation to your cart. Again, visit omahasteaks.com and enter code FTN in the search bar to get this great package for $49.99.
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup, I'm Steve Dorsey. Now to a CBS News exclusive, a 16-year-old girl is speaking out after she says she was sexually assaulted on a United Airlines flight from Seattle to Newark last month. CBS News isn't naming her or her mother, who both spoke to correspondent Anna Werner.
This was a big trip for that high schooler. She had won admission to a prestigious Young Women's Leadership Academy at Princeton University. But she says her red-eye flight on United Airlines soon took a traumatic turn.
I knew what was going on, but like I just thought I was dreaming or something. Like, this cannot really be happening.
The 16-year-old girl was traveling alone from Seattle, sleeping on her overnight United flight to Newark, when she says she awoke to find the stranger sitting next to her, touching her.
I could feel his hand on my thigh, and one of his hands had, like, came between my legs, and he was, like, rubbing me between my legs. And then he tried to put his other hand, like, underneath my pants, and then I kind of woke up, and I was like, what are you doing?
She reported it to a flight attendant, who moved her to another seat a few rows up, but says she was terrified.
But I just felt like he could see me, like he could see wherever I was sitting.
And why did that terrify you?
Because there was just still so much time. Like, I couldn't just leave the plane. I didn't have anyone. I didn't feel like there was anyone on the plane that could protect me.
And when the plane parked at the gate in Newark, the teenager says everyone simply walked off, including the man she says sexually assaulted her.
I literally thought I was going to die.
This is the 16-year-old's mother.
You thought you were going to die?
I'm 3,000 miles away. My child says she's been sexually assaulted, and I'm asking her questions, and she's like disoriented. I'm like, well, where is he? Do you see him? And she said, he just walked by me. And I said,
get the police, get United.
But her mother says when she finally got a United terminal supervisor on the phone...
At that point, the supervisor told me that United did not follow their own protocols. She said, you are the first person telling me of your daughter's assault. I don't have a manifest. I don't have a report. I don't even know who he is or where he is.
Later that day, police and the FBI, which handles incidents in the air, did track down a passenger and arrest him. Vijay Kumar Krishnappa, a visiting doctor on a fellowship, according to One Medical Center, is charged with one count of abusive sexual contact on an airplane. His attorney says Krishnappa adamantly denies the charges and deserves to be considered an innocent man. United did not answer CBS's questions, including about its protocol for reporting sexual assaults, instead saying in a statement, "We take these allegations seriously and are working with the authorities." But family attorney Mark Lamber faults United.
The FBI wasn't waiting when the plane landed, so the perpetrator, the man who engaged in sexual assault, walked off the plane with a free pass.
The FBI reports in 2016 it conducted 57 investigations into sexual assaults on airplanes, up from 40 in 2015. It's a statistic this mother never knew.
If I had any inclination that she could be assaulted, I never would have put my daughter on that flight. I would have flown with her.
You said that he took something from you. What did he take from you, do you think?
He had no right to touch me. He had no right. I guess I would say he took my peace of mind.
You don't feel safe?
No, I don't feel safe.
And Krishnappa is currently out on bail. If convicted, he could face 2 years in prison, a $250,000 fine, and possibly be deported.
Anna Werner reporting. It's a disturbing Snapchat video titled Nap Time Struggle.
A 10-second video uploaded to social media appears to show a woman sitting on and hitting children under her care at the North Charleston, South Carolina United Methodist Church Daycare Center. Senior Pastor Richard Reams' reaction to the video?
My first reaction probably isn't the best words to come out of a preacher's mouth, because I was a little surprised by it. There are multiple levels of that were disturbing and absolutely against our policy.
The church has fired the unidentified daycare worker who has not been charged criminally. Jim Crisula, CBS News.
Women who live in areas with higher levels of outdoor light at night may be at higher risk for breast cancer.
Peter James is an assistant professor at Harvard Medical School. He says the study examined data from nearly 110,000 nurses.
We looked at light at night and breast cancer incidence from 1989 to 2013. Luckily, we had previously geocoded the longitude and latitude of each participant's home address, and we were able to obtain light at night data from NOAA satellite images that date back to the 1990s.
James says women exposed to the highest levels of outdoor light at night had an estimated 14% increased risk of breast cancer during the study period. James admits further work is required to confirm the study's findings. Bill Rakoff, CBS News.
A British study finds children who regularly skip breakfast are missing key nutrients.
Iron, calcium, iodine, folate, nutrients crucial for growing children and missing in kids who don't eat breakfast every day.
Children who skip breakfast had up to 8 times lower levels of these nutrients.
Study author Gerda Pott, girls more likely to skip breakfast than boys and older kids more likely than younger. But this study shows all benefit from starting their day with a healthy breakfast. Vicky Barker, CBS News, London.
More hospitals are being targeted by hackers. CBS News correspondent Rena Ninen investigated the growing number of cyber attacks on hospitals across the country. Rena, what'd you learn?
It's amazing just how vulnerable hospitals across America are, and the capabilities of these hackers is pretty tremendous. They're able to get into patient records, and the next worry is that they could actually target records and change them, and doctors might not even know that they've been changed.
What's at stake here? Is it concerns about patient information, patient confidentiality, or something much more sinister?
I think those are all concerns that they have. But I think the biggest concern for many of these is how do you safeguard these hospitals? How do you protect patient history and medical records? If hackers can get them, what else can they access from a hospital? And they can now target your blood type. They could even get in and possibly erase your history. And imagine doctors going into elective surgery and not being able to get any of that information before they start to operate on you.
Why are there so many vulnerabilities?
It's a great question. I think for so long, hospitals never thought that they needed to protect their digital records, that they needed to safeguard their Wi-Fi networks. You know, there are frequently security right in front of a hospital or right in the lobby of a hospital building. there's security to guard the perimeters, but nobody's really thought about the digital security that's needed to protect medical records. And that's a growing trend that many hospitals across the country are now grappling with. And keep in mind, it's not cheap to hire white hat hackers to safeguard your personal information. Costs money, and that's an added expense that hospitals will have to take on.
You also visited India. Why?
Yeah, we found one of the best hackers in the world. He came from this really remote village. His parents moved to the big city of Mumbai, and it transformed his life and his socioeconomic status by getting into hacking. He hacks at night, and he's targeted companies like Uber. And these companies now pay him thousands and thousands of dollars to find vulnerabilities.
You can watch Rena's report on CBSN on assignment that airs Monday at 10 p.m. Eastern on CBS and on our digital streaming network, CBSN. Thanks, Rena.
Thank you.
Coming up on the Weekend Roundup, things are looking up.
You can actually see a halo of glowing light around the eclipse sun.
Follow us on Facebook and Twitter, where we've got headlines at CBS News Radio. And I'm tweeting at Steve_Dorsey on the CBS News Weekend Roundup. On the CBS News Weekend Roundup, I'm Steve Dorsey. It hasn't happened yet, and you may already be tired of hearing about it, but it's on the way. The total solar eclipse set to cross the U.S. Monday. Gil Gross talked with astronomer Andrew Fractoy for CBS News about some of the most common questions they've gotten about this rare event.
Why is this one so special?
Well, this is the first total eclipse of the sun that crosses the United States in the Internet age. So we think more people, perhaps than any other eclipse in history, will know about the eclipse and will try to look at the eclipse. It's also an eclipse that goes over some of the most populated territory in the world.
What exactly is going on with the Earth, Moon, and Sun during this eclipse?
Right. So when we have a total eclipse of the Sun, we have the situation that the Moon exactly covers the Sun. And because of that, when the Moon covers the Sun, the faint atmosphere of the sun becomes visible. It's as if the day had turned into night. It becomes dark where you are if you're in the total eclipse shadow. And you can actually see a halo of glowing light around the eclipse sun, which is the sun's atmosphere.
Is this going to happen in Earth in the future? Did this totally happen in the past? Because the Earth is slowing its spin. The Moon is going to move a little further away.
Right. So you know something that many people don't know, which is that very slowly, over cosmic amounts of time, the Moon is moving away from the Earth. So in the past, the eclipse was more than total. The Moon was so big it covered up the sun's atmosphere. In the remote future, as the Moon moves away, total eclipses won't be possible. But now, anytime in the foreseeable future, we are at the moment when eclipses are total, as seen from Earth.
Let's start moving some of the questions that we've gotten into this. John Wilkinson from San Lorenzo, California, says many years ago when the Moon was orbiting faster and closer to the Earth, how much more often did total solar eclipses happen? Was there ever a point where it happened every orbit of the Moon?
Well, so that's a great question. Let's make sure that everybody understands why eclipses are so rare. Because if you think about it, the Moon goes around the Earth every month. That's what the Moon does for a living.
Mm-hmm.
So if the Moon's going around...
And his mother is very proud.
That's right. It does a good job at that. So if the Moon is going around us every month, there will come a time every month when the Moon is in the same area of the sky as the Sun. Why then every month does an eclipse not happen? And here's the reason. The Moon's orbit is tilted relative to the orbit of the Earth around the Sun. So the two orbits are not lined up. Most of the time, because of this tilt in the orbit, when the Moon and the Sun are in the same part of the sky, the Moon is either above the Sun or below the Sun, and there's no eclipse. So think of these two orbits as two hula hoops that you're holding in your hand. If you tilt the hula hoops relative to each other, there'll be two places where the hula hoops actually cross. And those orbit crossings are when you can have an eclipse. So every 6 months or so, we have what we call eclipse season, We don't always get a total eclipse during eclipse season, and we certainly don't get a total eclipse over the United States every time this happens. But every 6 months or so, somewhere on Earth, eclipses are possible. So that's the situation. That's why eclipses like this are so rare. The other factor is that it can happen anywhere on the surface of the Earth, and two-thirds of the Earth's surface is water. So most of the time, this small shadow where the eclipse is total happens over an uninhabited portion of the globe, and no one's there. And this time, it's happening over the United States in a narrow path about 60 miles wide.
So take me to August 21st. What are we going to see? What's it going to look and feel like?
The people who are lucky enough to be in the total eclipse zone, which is a zone about 60 to 70 miles wide, starting on a beach in Oregon and going diagonally across the country to a beach in South Carolina. If you are in that total eclipse zone, you will see one of the most awesome sights of your life. You will see, as I said earlier, the moon covering the sun, day becoming night, the stars coming out, an eerie quiet descend on the landscape, the faint atmosphere of the sun glowing like patches of light and fire around the sun. It'll be something that you'll remember perhaps for the rest of your life. If you manage to get into that zone, you'll see this beautiful total eclipse. But if you don't, you'll still see something very interesting. From the rest of the United States, in fact, from all of North America, something like 500 million people will be able to see a partial eclipse of the sun. That means the sun won't be completely covered, but a good portion of the sun will be covered. And so you'll see the moon essentially taking a big bite out of the sun.
Sue Ronneberger in Northport, New York, asks, is it really dangerous to look for a few seconds with the naked eye?
Number one, sunglasses, no.
Useless.
Sunglasses are useless. You don't use the sunglasses to stare at the sun. So what does work? What works is welder's glass or welder's goggles as long as they're number 14 or greater. The second thing are these inexpensive paper glasses with the special plastic material. If you don't have any one of those, then the deal is that you should try to project an image of the sun rather than looking at the sun directly. And let me give two suggestions, Gil, for what people can do that's pretty easy to do with everyday material. One technique is to take a hand mirror or a woman's compact mirror, and the day before, cover all of the mirror with cardboard, leaving only a hole about the size of a dime. Try to take a reflection of the sun in this mirror and project it onto a wall. That projected image on the wall is absolutely safe to look at, and you can see a big bite taken out of the sun. A much easier way to get a quick view of what's happening is to use pinhole projection, to make a pinhole in a piece of paper, take another piece of paper, and then project an image of the sun. But that's a very small image when you do it. It's not very great. So here's my favorite.
Yes.
Bring a colander. You know about your colander? Your colander at home is a device for washing vegetables and fruit and so on, and it's full of little holes. When you go out during the eclipse, stand with your back to the sun, hold the colander over your shoulder so it makes a shadow on the sidewalk, and there in the shadow of the pinholes, you'll see multiple images of the eclipse sun with a nice bite taken out of it. So that's my favorite way to look at the partial eclipses, to hold a colander over my shoulder. It also immediately attracts attention. So everybody comes and asks, what's going on? What's going on? And you can be the hero of the street showing this great eclipse to everybody.
You're right.
Coming up, how music can help people cope with Alzheimer's.
Music lights up many parts of the brain.
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
The CBS News Weekend Roundup after this short break.
Like what you're hearing? Get even more great content from CBS Radio News podcasts. Listen to TV broadcasts like The Evening News and Face the Nation on demand. Or hear original audio programming like our weekend review show, The Weekend Roundup. You can also hear the story behind the story on Reporter's Notebook, or what's hot on Tech Talk with Larry Magid. Get these podcasts and more from iTunes, Stitcher, or Google Play today.
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup, I'm Steve Dorsey. Music is bringing new hope to Alzheimer's patients and their families. More from CBS News Chief Medical Correspondent Dr. John LaPook.
Each week, the DJ spins oldies but goodies at the Toad Hill Senior Center on Staten Island. Also taking a spin, 74-year-old Carol Daly, who was diagnosed with Alzheimer's 12 years ago. We've been following Carol and her husband Mike since 2008.
Me and my husband Mike.
Charting her decline.
What's your husband's name?
My husband's?
Your husband's name.
Yeah.
Witnessing their love story. When we met again this spring, Carol was barely talking.
And I really see a tremendous difference
mm-hmm.
in Carol. What do you see?
Sadness. This is what we lived so long for.
Caregivers like Mike Daly are desperate for anything that can improve quality of life. So we introduced the Dalys to the Music and Memory Program, created by social worker Dan Cohn.
Our senses, sight, smell, really light up a very small part of the brain. But music lights up many parts of the brain. So even though the brain may deteriorate in certain areas, other areas of the brain are still very much there.
And that gave Cohn an idea. In 2008, he started handing out iPods to nursing home residents so they could have personalized music. Cobble Hill Health Center in Brooklyn was one of the first to give it a try. A decade later, it's in some 4,500 sites.
Okay, we're going to play some music.
Okay.
In the Music and Memory Program, family and friends create the playlist. Cohn says the headphones help eliminate distractions.
She said Pretender exactly as it said Pretender.
Yes.
So she's on the beat.
Since the music we love is really tied to our emotional system, and our emotional system is still very much intact, that's what we're connecting, and that's what still works.
Emotional for Mike Daly as well.
Yeah, it's more than I can deal with, I can handle.
It's poignant. Is it a good poignant?
Yes. It's knowing that she hasn't lost it all.
And now you're looking at me right in my eyes, which you were not doing before. And you're singing beautifully.
We always talk about the risks and benefits of therapies. Well, it's hard to see much of a downside here. And it was so moving to watch Carol sing and give us a glimpse, if only for a few seconds, into who she used to be. Dr. John LaPook, CBS News, New York.
Now here's CBS News correspondent Sam Litzinger on the intersection of philosophy and surfing.
It's been a long time since I've found somebody like Aaron James. He's a philosopher. Actually, I know quite a lot of philosophers. What I don't know is a lot of philosophers who've written a book titled Surfing with Sartre, an aquatic journey into a life of meaning. Kind of a combination of, well, as you might expect, Sartre and surfing.
I mean, not only, you know, is surfing intrinsically worth doing as a good way to spend your limited time in life, but these days, you know, it's a kind of contribution to society, if only because you're doing something less consumptive ecologically than other things you might be doing, like working, for example.
Why do we work in the first place? I mean, obviously the basic needs have to be met, but a lot of people work a lot. Why do they do that?
Yeah, well, I mean, for good reasons. There's the exercise of skill. There's the desire for mastery, for status, you know, the intrinsic interest of it, the enjoyment of developing your abilities. All good reasons, but not good enough reasons to justify working for money as much as we do when we could, you know, find other kinds of meaning in surfing or other, you know, skillful leisure activities.
Where'd you learn to surf?
San Diego. I grew up in San Diego.
And so did you take to the water from a young age?
I did. In fact, I had a deal with my father that I could skip high school when the waves were particularly good. If I could make the case for him that the swell was on, he'd call in sick for me.
Wow, that's pretty good. Is that how you learned to be a philosopher, to argue your case?
I suppose that was part of it, yeah.
Why'd you go into philosophy?
Yeah, well, I was gripped by it in college and, you know, just found it really exciting. didn't so much think of it as a career choice necessarily. I just wanted to keep doing it. And then only sort of squared that with my interest in surfing after I managed to get a job back in California at the University of California, Irvine.
You write in the book, the surfer wisdom for success as a person is this: take it easier, accept, persist, focus, leave time, don't compare, and mix things up. Pretty good advice generally. Is that philosophical advice or just really surfer advice?
I think that's, it's a kind of philosophical advice, but it's inspired by what surfers know and understand about the good life. I mean, surfers really have a sense that they're sort of blessed in their existence in a certain way. And it's partly because, you know, they live a life sort of bathed in the sublime beauty of the waves. Even on an ordinary day, there's a real sense of joy and gratitude that comes from that. And I think it's from reflecting on that value and in contrast with a sort of money-hungry, status-striving culture, you know, that's asking you to, you know, to push harder, ever harder, work harder, demanding more of your time and attention. You know, I think those are sort of things you can do to sort of, tune it out or not be owned by the mania of the culture.
Can you be a philosopher and still be a jerk?
Yeah, it's an interesting possibility because you might think that the opposite of a jerk is a surfer. You know, surfers know how to be attuned to the wave, and you might think they can be attuned to people and so wouldn't be a jerk. But oddly, jerk surfers exist. Mostly, I don't think they're any more likely to be jerks than other people. But, you know, in the surfing lineup, when surfers are competing for waves, a scarce resource, there are rules of etiquette and stuff, and so you can get jerky behavior, you know, in cheating around the rules and such.
Do you think Sartre would actually surf?
He doesn't look like the most athletic type, but he does write as though he skied. So I think maybe he'd give it a try. Although surfing is very difficult. It's difficult to learn, more difficult than skiing. So maybe, you know, he'd have to stick with it down on the beaches of France, you know, South France, if he were to actually do it.
The book is Surfing with Sartre, An Aquatic Journey into a Life of Meaning. The author is philosopher Aaron James. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks so much. It's been a pleasure.
I'm Sam Litzing.
That does it for the Weekend Roundup. Thanks for listening. We want to get your feedback. Send us your story ideas, chain letters, love letters, whatever, to weekendroundup@cbsnews.com. The show's always online on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher, and now Spotify. The Weekend Roundup is produced at the CBS News Washington Bureau. Lou Walker is the technical supervisor. Dory Valerio is the production assistant in New York. Have a great week. I'm Steve Dorsey, CBS News.